Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals 8 p.m. Wednesday, and it's time for So What's Your Story? It's the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Hank Rubicek, and alongside a team soaked with creative genius, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, media maven and engineer Nicole Rocherlin, and remarkably resourceful intern Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls with personal stories and transport us to the enchanting worlds of folk tales and fables before returning us safely to the present. You know, around 270 AD, a kindly priest by the name of Saint Valentine held secret marriage ceremonies for soldiers in opposition to King Claudius, who prohibited marriage for young men, believing they'd want to remain home with their wives rather than fight. Now, though the ban on marriage was a shock for Romans, they dared not voice their protest to the mighty emperor. For disobeying the order, St. Valentine was executed on February 14th, and in his dying breath said, "Love conquers all." Okay, I made that part up. But it's a folk tale, you know, it's a common take on the day Cupid shoots arrows into the hearts of unsuspecting lovers. Whatever the version, folk tales are meant to keep traditions alive, and February 14th is certainly a day to remember. It's a day to reminisce about love, or love lost, or gone wrong, or love imagined. You know, we cook up a lot of great stuff every week on this program, and tonight we're going to serve up some punchy and poignant Valentine's Day dishes from a fusion of ingredients stirred up by three terrific tellers whose narratives and folklore proves why we keep this thing called love alive. Paul Topikian has been on before, and when you listen to his skill set, you're going to know why he's back again. Raised in Yonkers, New York, Paul's lived in Houston for 30 years, and he's worked as a cab driver, a pool builder, shipping clerk, but is especially proud of his role as husband, parent, and grandpa. The consummate storyteller, his repertoire is rich and varied. He's a frequent teller at the Moth, and he told at the Moth Grand Slam this past November. Jackie Ford's another return guest who's going to be bringing us her story by phone from Columbus, Ohio, an attorney for the Boreas Law Firm in Houston and Columbus. Jackie specializes in labor and employment law. Her signature style is compelling and raw, and we're excited that she's going to be joining us in just a few minutes. Author and storyteller R.D. Vincent, that's his pen name, Ray, ran into fellow storyteller Scott Bumgardner, who contacted me, and I'm glad he did. He was born in Goshen, New York, on a small dairy farm with his brother and sister. He writes original folk tales, each laced with a parable and fueled by a narrative formula that is deservedly his own. How's everybody doing tonight?
Doing really, really
Love
well.
Love is in the air. Everybody's got their candy, flowers, all that stuff. We make a big deal about Valentine's Day, but it's a fun day. It is, right?
Absolutely.
You got to do something.
True.
No?
True.
Right, right. Yeah. There's a little bit of romanticism in the air. Paul, welcome back. You know, I've been wanting to ask you, of all of your jobs that you've had, which was your favorite?
Well, I think the two jobs. The first job I had right out of college was building a swimming pool at the college I had worked at, which was, I mean, they gave us $1.5 million worth of equipment and supplies and 70 students, and we built a swimming pool, which was pretty amazing.
Nice.
But I also had a wonderful job. Last job at Exxon was setting up a service center down in Guatemala, and that was sort of a building exercise also. And that was
I remember you talking about that. That's not in this eclectic list, but that's pretty cool. Yeah. You worked for Exxon for a while, didn't you?
Almost 5 years.
20 years. A lot of fun being a grandfather?
Absolutely.
I'm a grandfather, so I'm sure you're not a grandfather, but you may have a grandfather because you're so young.
I definitely
What, are you 10 yet, 15? 36?
I'm 12 36. Going on 39.
Yeah, my God, he is so young. You know, people who are young are really starting to piss me off because there are too many of them. You know what I mean? But being a grandfather is a lot of fun. Ray, tell us a moment when you first recognized the power of storytelling. I know that's a tough question, but what do you think?
I think it was a time when I was growing up on my farm in New York and going into Grandma's house and just listening to her talk from her kitchen while she was cooking and baking, and those words were memorable coming
out. And you know, I talk about this a lot, that my grandmother was the consummate storyteller. That's really where I learned about it. Everything she said was in story form. So I really do understand that. Now, why do you use a folktale design? You know, a lot of people use personal narratives.
Yeah, I think folktale is something that we kind of need to latch on to here. A lot of the stories that have been passed on through generations are focused in our own way, and I think we need to hold on to that. I think just like European history, they had tons of folktales. I think some of our tales are being lost through our elderly, and we need to listen to them to hang on to them.
Yeah, so. I think that's a very good point. Yeah, folktales are things that are so generational. Well, so are personal stories, but folktales in particular. We're going to get to your stories in a little while because they're very exciting in a way, because we very rarely have people on who actually write their own folktales. So this is going to be very cool. Paul, let's kick it off with you. In my opinion, no one really crafts stories with more intriguing themes than you. You really do a good job, my friend. And your first one, Come to Jesus, you know, here's a good example, sounds like a wild Valentine story, right?
Well, it is. And, you know, most people, when they have that kind of come to Jesus moment, you know, it's usually the result of having, you know, some sort of near-death experience. Mine came about after spending about 2.5 hours with my arm stuck in this Coke machine in the basement of my dorm. You know, I was sitting there with my arm stuck on the floor, and there's this parade of folks coming by offering suggestions how I could get my arm out. None of them worked. And, you know, I was there for a long time, and I really needed to pee. And I don't know whether it was my bladder filling or the fact that I had been sitting there that long, but I realized at that point that I just needed to make some changes in my life. Mm-hmm. Now, you're probably wondering, what the hell am I doing on the floor with my arm stuck in this Coke machine? Well, among the many firsts that I experienced that semester, you know, one of them was going to my first Grateful Dead concert. I tried magic mushrooms, which ended up with me in a dorm room the next morning with no recollection of how I got there, and a pierced ear. And I lost my virginity that semester. But in addition to that...
By the Coke machine? Not by the...
Not by the Coke machine, and not with the magic mushrooms. Yeah. But we'll get to that. One of the things I learned from the master was how I could finesse Cokes out of this machine. And it was really fairly easy. You just had to have a relatively thin hand, thin wrist. You'd snake your arm up in, push the bottles up, turn the one at the bottom 90 degrees, pull it down, and it would just pop right out. And, you know, I could get Cokes for myself and Cokes for my friend. The problem this time was that there were too many Cokes in the machine, and when I pushed my hand up, they slipped down and I got pinned. And it became like this Gordian knot. The more I moved, the more I was stuck. So we tried all sorts of things to get my arm out, rocking the machine gently, rocking the machine a little bit more challengingly. None of this was working, and I was forced at that point to kind of fall on my sword, which was calling up the guy who had the key to the machine to come over and get my arm out. The problem with that was I was going to end up in the dean's office because, you know, technically I was trying to steal a 15-cent Coke out of this Coke machine. But unfortunately, I didn't really see that there was a way out. Now, 2 hours of kneeling in front of a Coke machine is a long time, even with the interruption of all these folks coming by, some coming to get a Coke, some coming down to offer advice, and some just coming down to look at this stupid freshman that's got his arm stuck in the Coke machine. But sitting on the floor there, well, it was a little bit like being in the stocks at the Boston Commons, and it was humiliating and painful. And I really needed to pee. In that 2 hours, my mind was drifting, and it was covering a range of topics, but it kept coming back to my losing my virginity and my girlfriend Eileen, who was the love of my life. Unfortunately, I didn't lose my virginity with Eileen, despite all my best efforts, and I do mean best efforts. She was back in New York. I was in Illinois. Now, it had been this older woman. She was 20. I was 17. You know, it was a back rub that had started as a back rub that had turned into a front rub that had moved downward. And in addition to losing my virginity, I experienced, how shall we say, I guess, other delights. And over the next 5 weeks, I just came to realize several things. I was very, very much in love with Eileen, I was guilty as all hell, and I really, really liked to have sex. And I needed more practice. I would love to have had sex with Eileen, but the distance was a problem, so what to do? But more immediately, I'm kneeling on the floor in front of this Coke machine. I mean, I really needed to pee. So with the guy with the key nowhere to be found, I decided it was time to go with the kind of the nuclear option. That entailed laying the machine over on its side so that I could wiggle my arm out. And if that didn't work, we were going to tip it up on its top, for that would work. For this, we needed a mattress and a ladder. And my buddy Butzo, who had taught me how to get my arm into the machine, was the one that had gone off to get that equipment. He showed up with it right at the same time that the guy with the key showed up. It took him less than a minute to get my hand out, and the following Monday, I had a verbal warning from Dean Gordon. I had to go in and see the dean. Dean said, "Paul, that was a pretty stupid thing to do. Don't do it again." Pretty good verbal warning. And I can say I actually didn't. I actually swore off Coke altogether, and I became a cream soda guy, and I never violated that Coke machine again. But more importantly, I broke up with Barb, the older woman, and boy, was she pissed at me. Not because she was in love with me or anything, but more because she had wasted 5 weeks of training on, as she said, this wimp who was going to go back to his high school sweetheart who wouldn't even put out for him. Suffice to say, I was replaced rather quickly. Now, this is a true love conquers all story, and I'm glad to say that I stayed faithful to Eileen to the end, which was about a year later when she dumped me. At that point, I had flunked out of college. I was back in Yonkers. I was driving a forklift in a dead-end warehouse job, working too much, not much fun to be with. Confessions can be good for the soul, but they can be not so good for your relationship. It's better not to get yourself in those situations in the first place, much like not getting yourself in a situation where you need the guy with the key to the Coke machine to come and get you out. Plus, it seemed that someone had been sneaking around her back door, and well, he was more enticing than I was, despite all my new skills. But that didn't last. She and I started seeing each other again on and off, and I'm happy to say at this point, you know, we're both very much in love and happily married. Just happens to be the other people. You know, there's a Stone song that I think it fits this very well. You know, you can't always get what you want, but you get what you need. And if you're lucky, like in my case, what you end up with a very, very nice enduring friendship. And in my case, a very wonderful marriage to another woman.
Fabulous. So you are friends with her.
Oh, absolutely. So, right? She's probably cool. Listening and yeah. Cringing.
Right. You flunked out of college because of her, would you say?
I flunked out of college I would attribute a bit of it to mm-hmm. homesickness and being in love.
Yeah.
But I would generally attribute mm-hmm. it to being a 17-year-old at college and just not having my act together.
Yeah. Unbelievable. I love it. Love it. Great story. Great story. You know, by the way, this is not the first night of love, because next week, Mary Edgerton is going to bring you love letters right here only on So What's Your Story. When Jackie Ford told a story at the month a couple of years ago, I personally ambushed her at Warehouse Live because I had to have her tell the story on the show. And her stories are really nothing less than beautiful. And I hope that Nicole managed to get her on the line. Jackie, are you there?
Hi, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. It's nice and cozy here in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, snowing, is it? What's going on there?
Snow. Cold, okay. And some more snow and some more cold.
And I'll bet, Jackie, that the one thing that you really wanted to do tonight was to tell a story right here on the air, right?
Well, you know, I do love storytelling, so I always like a chance to do that.
And we love having you on, and we want to really thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time. Now, I'm not going to say a whole lot about your story, but it is about an unlikely couple who lived a love story. Is that fair?
I think that's a fair summary.
Is there anything that you need for us to know before you tell us the story?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I think it can kind of tell itself.
Well, we're looking forward to it.
Thank you. My sister met her husband at an AA meeting. And I know that seems like an unlikely place for romance to bloom, but it actually always made perfect sense to me. Because otherwise, what could possibly explain how these two would have ever gotten together? And it seemed like the glue of AA itself and their, you know, shared commitment to dealing with their addiction and the commitment and the hard work and everything that that took, that made sense to me as a connection, because otherwise they did not make any sense as a couple. They didn't make any sense just to look at the two of them as a pair. You'd think, what is she doing with him? You'd have to understand, my sister Lynn was the most stunningly beautiful woman I ever saw. She had these amazing high cheekbones, perfect dimples, big green eyes, long lashes, black hair on top of her head. If you can remember Linda Carter, the actress who played Wonder Woman on television back in the day, my sister was a dead ringer for her, so much so that people would stop her on the street when we were in D.C., where Linda Carter lived. They would stop her on the street and ask her for an autograph, and Lynn would say, I can't sign that. I said, just sign it. Just sign it. L-Y-N-D. Just sign it. You'll give these people a great story they'll have for the rest of their lives. So she would do this, and this happened more than once. So this stunning, sophisticated, beautiful woman never left the house without her hair and makeup done, wouldn't pick up the mail without her hair and makeup done. This gorgeous woman marries a guy who's a plumber and pipe fitter. Nothing remarkable about him, and nothing remarkable. In fact, his most remarkable physical characteristic was a tattoo that ran from his elbow all the way down to his wrist, full frontal of a naked woman. Hardly the sort of thing that my sophisticated sister would think to be attracted to. And that's why I always kept coming back to this story of how they met at AA, because it just explains so much. And over the years, we spent a lot of time together, and I got closer and closer to both of them, and I adored them both. And then one February morning, terrible morning a couple of years ago, Lynn called me, and her voice was cracking. She was calling to tell me that David died of a massive heart attack, and certainly part of her died that day. And she asked me if I would give the eulogy for him, and I was very honored and said, of course I would do that. So I traveled to the town where they lived, and 2 days later I was getting ready to give the eulogy, and just before I was going to start, I thought, oh, I better check this with her. So I said, Lynn, is it okay if I tell the story about how you two met at AA? I mean, I know some people are private about that. Is it okay if I tell that? She said, what are you talking about? We didn't meet at an AA meeting. I said, what? What? You didn't? No, of course not. Who told you that? I said, honestly, I don't remember, but the whole family has always told that story. She's looking around at the family. She goes, that's not true. I knew him for a long time before we were in AA together. We didn't meet there. And I thought, oh, well, gosh, there goes the whole eulogy. Okay, I have to rewrite in the next couple minutes. And I gave the eulogy, and I was all the more puzzled. Like, well, what brought you together? What attracted you to him then? So about a year and a half later, unfortunately, Lynn was the one who was leaving us. In some ways, she never got over Dave's death, and she always seemed to have this cloud around her, and this sadness seemed to always be in the wings. And sure enough, it turned out she had terminal ovarian cancer. And in one of the last conversations I had with her, we were sitting together on the couch at her house a Saturday after Thanksgiving, and she was pale, and the cheekbones were just gone. Her cheeks were just sunken, and she was in her nightgown at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, no hair, no makeup, so you knew it was a pretty bad day. And we were sitting there just silently on the couch together, and we're not really talking about anything. And all of a sudden she says to me, you know, I guess I was pretty lucky. I said, what do you mean, lucky about what? She says, you know, the whole time we were married, every single morning when it was time for me to go to work, Dave would go over and go out the garage, put the garage door up, turn my car on, take the car out of the garage, turn it around, back it back into the garage, and then come back in, leave the car running so that I'd have a warm car to get into and I wouldn't have to back down that long driveway. He did that for me every day. And I realized what she was telling me was that was what attracted her to him. That was the secret of that marriage and that long relationship. It was a very simple thing. That man loved my sister. And that was the secret of the love story.
Wow, Jackie, thank you so much for a lot of reasons. You know, You were there the night at the Muff, and Paul, you might have been too, and I was telling a story about my friends, and one of them wanted to dance with his wife. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful story.
That is what this reminds me of.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it reminds me of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the story is that, you know, people are looking at me. The story was is that a couple that I knew the husband always wanted to dance with his wife, and she didn't want to because she was making dinner. And one day he wanted to dance, and she said, go take a nap, and he did. And she went to wake him up, and he died, had a massive coronary. And mm-hmm. when I went to the funeral, she said to me, you know, if he were here, I'd let him dance with me all night and let everything burn, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what this story reminds me of. That was such a beautiful story.
Well, Jackie. They were really such an unlikely couple, and they made each other so happy.
What a beautiful story.
Thank you.
What a beautiful story. There's an awful lot that we need to get from that, but in a sentence, what do you think we need to draw from that?
I think love is found in the simple things and in the simple ways that people who love each other want to make each other's lives better. You know, Dave was not a man of money or means or sophistication, mm-hmm. but in his own way, he made her life better every day.
He was an incredible man, though. And
that story itself
reinforces that. You going to be able to hang with us a little bit, or you need to get going?
No, I can hang on the phone.
Okay, great. Thank you. That was so beautiful. This is Hank Rupacek with Nicole Rochelin and Tatiana Gago. And tonight it's all about love with guest tellers Artie Vinson, Paul Topekian, and Jackie Ford on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 90.1 in Huntsville. Ray, each story that you have for us tonight surrounds itself with a storytelling grandmother, right?
Yes, that's great.
And first of all, tell us, what's special about a grandmother's voice?
I think it's that wisdom that just resonates out when they speak. You know, you see that they've been on this planet for ages, and they just have such wisdom and such knowledge when they speak, and always a great tone to have you locked right in.
Paul and I are sitting here, and we're grandparents. We haven't been here for ages, but we've been here a couple of years, right? A couple of years, and wisdom. Hey, well, are we sure sensitive about that? Damn right. Right. We sure are. Now, your first story, The Caretaker of Donbridge, is about a woman who saves the town from hunger, which is a really profound lesson about love. Tell us about that story.
It was Thanksgiving Day, and my siblings were bustling about my mother's kitchen, baking and preparing side dishes for our family feast. While we worked, a sudden rapping could be heard from the front door. Standing in the brisk air was our grandmother, waiting to come inside. As she entered our house, she hugged all of us. She made her way to a chair. While she sat, she looked about the room, observing all the food we were preparing. My brother and I watched her as we peeled Macintosh apples for apple cranberry pie. Then she began to gaze upon a jar of canned pickles which sat on the kitchen table. My mother looked to her and asked her if something was wrong, but my grandmother just shook her head in a polite nod. But as usual, she began to tell a tale from her beloved town of Dunbridge. It was the end of summer in the Great Valley of Dunbridge, and the crops of the year were hit with a massive blight. The Taylor Farm, the primary supplier of vegetables, lost the majority of their crops, and the Miller's Orchard lost their entire harvest of berries, peaches, and apples from juniper spores and Japanese beetles. Even though many farmers owned small gardens, their production was limited. Soon the town folks began to fear the worst. But Midwife Sutton, a resourceful type, knew a secret that not many knew. High in the tamarack forest, where a blue waterfall cascaded off the mountaintop, a lady named Evelyn Depew lived in a rustic cedar cabin. There she lived amongst the forest, cultivating and jarring green beans, asparagus, and peas. She even worked the mountainside, gathering blackberries, blueberries, and wild strawberries. Evelyn raised egg-laying chickens, and each day would boil and pickle the eggs she found. Each fall, she would harvest tree-vine grapes and canned jellies and storing it all away in a cave she kept protected. Her supplies were vast, and it was said that her supplies would feed 100 people for 2 years if necessary. Back in Dunbridge, the end of November had arrived, and folks saw the first ice storm, which were locked and landscaped into a frozen state. Food shortage had hindered the annual Thanksgiving feast that had been held at the church for the past 50 years, and Midwife Sutton, knowing of Evelyn, felt compelled to pay her a visit. When Midwife Sutton arrived at Evelyn's house, she was shocked to see Evelyn outside filling a massive buckboard wagon and neatly packing jars of preserves. Evelyn looked up at her work and said, "People need hope, people need friends, and no one in my town will starve if I can help it." Evelyn continued to pack the food upon the wagon. "Please tell everyone to be at the church by 5 o'clock tonight," Evelyn proclaimed. Nodding her acknowledgement, the midwife rode her horse back to town. As the sun set over Dunbridge, the entire town stood outside the church. As the clock tower struck 5, suddenly the great doors opened, and there, inside the vestibule of the lit church, Evelyn stood. Behind her were vast tables set with food in the annual celebration, and off on the sides were tables upon tables of food that stretched the entire church. Mason jars were stacked with 3 and 4 high and bagged grains that sat upon the floor. "All of you are my friends, and all of you are my family. Together we will live and enjoy our Thanksgiving and survive this winter. Take as much food as you need, and know that I have plenty more to offer," Evelyn said, smiling. The entire town was shocked beyond words, and soon each person came to Evelyn, one by one, hugging her before they sat at the massive table. When all were seated, the Reverend stood up, blessed the meal in the town, and bestowed their title of caretaker upon Evelyn, whose efforts would feed the town for the entire winter. "When my grandmother stood up and left the table, she said, 'I would see you later at my house.' That evening, when we arrived at our grandparents' farmhouse, my mother, who had pickled beets, asked me to grab the jar from her car. I found no beets in the back seat, and my grandmother asked me to go to her cellar to fetch a jar. When I walked down my grandmother's stairs, to my surprise, I found room after room filled with jarred vegetables, fruits, all neatly preserved. Going back upstairs, I asked my grandmother, 'Why would you have so much food canned in your basement, grandmother?' My grandmother smiled and said, 'You never know when you need to feed a town.'"
Fabulous. Why Dunbridge?
Dunbridge?
Yeah.
It's a town I came up with as a fabled town in New York to house all of our family stories and tales.
Wow. Artie, Ray's got 2 books, Dunbridge, The Legend of Tamarack Hill, and Dunbridge, The Ring of Lazarus, both pretty magnificent. Beautiful story. What's the seed of this kind of a story? Sit down, what do you think about, Ray?
Well, I was thinking about my grandmother. I mean, she would always can and bake, and she always would have tons of, every year when we'd go to her kitchen, there would just be, it would be like a factory happening in there, and she'd be baking, cooking, and preserving tons of stuff, canning it, and the steam would fill the room like condensation.
Did your grandmother cook a lot?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? A lot? Yeah. Jackie, what about you? Your grandparents, your grandmother cook a lot?
Oh, yeah. And actually, my sister Lynn, who I was talking about earlier, was the single greatest cook I ever met in my life.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. My grandmother cooked as if there was going to be an atom bomb.
Absolutely.
Moment. And we're all coming to my basement. You know, that was
and, exactly.
I don't know. She had a kitchen in the basement because she didn't want to get the kitchen upstairs dirty. You know, I don't know. You know, she was a Holocaust survivor, so she wasn't totally normal anyway. She had bread in her purse so she wouldn't go hungry. It's kind of sad in a way. Grandmothers are unbelievable. Storytelling is perfect for Valentine's Day because there's nothing more romantic than reminding your essential other how you met and what you felt. And the better you are at communicating those loving thoughts, the better. And Nicole's going to tell us where you can communicate them well. Isn't that right, Nicole?
Absolutely, it is. Well, I don't if they can teach you to sound romantic, but our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, can certainly help you put just about anything in story form. And actually, they meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. Be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events and all our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, listed on the menu under radio program. What else, Tatiana?
One of those upcoming events is a program called The Best of the Guild, when guild members tell their favorite stories at company on stage on March 9th and 10th. Hank and Warren will be 2 of the tellers, so plan on getting there. Again, all the details are on the Guild's website.
Thanks, Tatiana. We also want our listeners to know that not having a radio is no excuse for missing our wonderful program, because you can listen to us live stream on kpft.org and Facebook Live. We're on there now. Tell us what they think about our show, or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and we promise to get back to you. And please be sure to share our page with your friends, and we'd love it if you like us before and when you leave. Is there anything else, Tatiana?
Yes, there is. Our good friends at The Moth will keep the language of love going when stories about love hurts are told next Tuesday, February 13th at Warehouse Live.
guys. Love hurts. I don't know. Jackie, you know, that theme is around every year. What do you think? Is that, can't we change that a little bit? Love
what,
hurts.
What, that love hurts?
Yeah. I mean, can't we do something like love doesn't hurt? Or maybe love is nice? I don't know.
I think if it's always easy and always simple and never hurts at all, then maybe it wasn't love in the first place.
I don't know, but Paul has got Eileen on his mind, and that's terrible. And the Coke machine, and my God, it's just awful.
Well, the Coke machine hurt.
The Coke machine did hurt, I've got to tell you. But, you know, one of the things that I've heard, one common denominator among all the stories that we're hearing so far is really about active listening. You know, Jackie's story really struck me in a way that her brother-in-law listened to her sister, right? You're talking about how your grandmother listened, not just to you, but really to the neighborhood, mm-hmm. the entire community, because it's based on Donbridge. It's not just based on you. And, you know, Paul's talking about, you know, that wonderful innocence of youth and how reflective and how very real it is and very true it is when we're kids. Because when we're kids, it's not goofy. It's very serious.
It's real.
You know, it's really mm-hmm. very, very serious. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. You know, what? By the way, Nicole, Tatiana, I got to ask you, too, this. What is the most romantic thing that ever happened to you? I'm almost afraid to ask Nicole, but what the hell? It's an adult show. I think Ray's kids listening, so be careful with what you say. Please.
Don't be afraid. Actually, I have not had that many romantic moments in all of the years of my life until recently. My boyfriend, who is very dear to me, he the most romantic thing outside of buying me diamonds and, you know, showering me with gifts. But the very thing that
get what Jackie said about simple things.
You know what? I tell them all the time. Your time. It's the time that I appreciate the most. But yeah. the very first thing that's in first place is when I was going through something and he asked me, what do you want me to pray for? And we got down on our knees and prayed. That was the most romantic thing.
I like it.
Ever.
Tatiana, what about you? I like that. That's beautiful.
Well, Dr. Rubicek,
others... You got something goofy, I know. Tell.
I know him.
Yeah. Well, other than ex-boyfriends running away from me when they see me in public, mm-hmm. but I had one date last year on Valentine's Day. He was an hour late, but nevertheless, he gave me the biggest box of chocolates. They were very, very delicious,
great.
And one beautiful rose.
And you took the chocolate
just one
and
rose.
Said,
one
goodbye,
rose.
Right? And you essentially said, thank you for the chocolate, but...
Because you're late.
did you still have a date with him, or did you just take the chocolate and run?
Oh, no, I had a date with him. It was a good evening. Very cold, but it was a good evening.
Probably very short. Again, now, Paul, I'm not sure that your next story, four words you never want to hear, smacks of romance, but let's have it.
Well, I mean, your fiance comes to you and says, or your wife, or your boss, it doesn't matter who it is, when somebody comes and says, we need to talk,
God,
what's going to happen next is not going to be good.
Nothing.
And in this
nothing.
Case, it was my then fiance Liz, and it was like, uh-oh, this is going to be bad. She and I had been together for about 3 years, and we had met at a party, and we had clicked immediately. We were both in our mid-20s. We shared interests in music, politics. She had a dog. I had cats. She was attractive, smart. And I had had enough relationships to know that this was the person I wanted to be with. So I was head over heels. I mean, I think that would have been an understatement. And after much courting, we had gotten engaged and set a date. The date was May 15th, 1983. And then came the We Need to Talk Day, which was, if I remember correctly, it was a Sunday early in 83. And that conversation went something like, you know, Liz comes down and is like, Paul, I really can't marry you. And my response was like, okay, why? And her response was, you know, I really can't explain it other than this feeling has been building for some time. And it's just the whole idea of marriage. And, you know, I thought of marriage to me. That just scared the hell out of her. But she said, I love you. I love you. And I remember saying, yeah, right. Okay. So that kind of thing, when it happens, tends to bring on a fair amount of introspection. You know, you look back at yourself and you say, okay, well, maybe, you know, saying, well, I guess we should get married, and sounding a little bit like Eeyore on Winnie the Pooh wasn't the best way to start. You know, romance has never really been one of my strong suits. And then following that up shortly by demanding that she quit smoking probably wasn't a wise move. You know, relationships are full of big and small negotiations, and I clearly learned that I didn't have a very strong hand there. Now, this is not to say that, you know, she wasn't going to marry me because she wasn't going to quit smoking, but I kind of got the picture that, you know, ultimatums in a relationship really don't work well. After, I want to say maybe 4 or 5 really awkward days, it became apparent that we really needed to start telling people about the fact, particularly our parents, that we were going to call this marriage off. Now, Liz's parents were very supportive of her. Actually, her mom and she had been talking quite frequently, and her mom had been counseling her, with salient, important pieces of information such as, you know, husbands, you can't fix them. Whatever's wrong with them now, it's only going to get worse as time goes on. I wasn't really worried about what my dad's reaction was going to be, but I knew talking to my mom about this was going to be a problem. Now, there's an ongoing, unfortunate tradition in my family of people calling weddings off immediately before the wedding date. Started with my dad, who called off his first wedding, not to my mom, but to his fiance, 2 weeks before the wedding. He was, I think, marrying up at that point in time, and I remember his comment to me was, "Never marry for money, it's cheaper to borrow." My sister, Laura, had called off her wedding less than a year earlier, about 6 weeks before, and had gone off and, you know, run off with some other guy who she ultimately married. So I knew when I called up my mom and told her that we weren't getting married, that this was not going to go well. Now, my mom, very strong Christian woman, does not curse. Criminetly was like the worst that she would say. Nobody really knows what that meant, but if she was upset, that's what came out. So when I told her what was taking place, her first response was, "What?" followed by, "Oh, shoot," except there wasn't an OU in there. There was another letter. That was followed by her just handing the phone off to my dad. And my dad was cool. He was like, "You know, don't worry, this too shall pass." And then he said, "You know, whatever happens with you and Liz will ultimately be for the best," which, spoken the way he spoke it, yeah, that was probably reflective of his calling off his first wedding being good, but it didn't seem all that optimistic to me. Liz and I tried to figure out, you know, sort of how to go on from there, how to salvage this, how to keep it going. We tried counseling. We tried living apart. We tried living together. We tried talking about it. We tried not talking about it. At one point in time, I concluded that, maybe withholding sex would have an effect and cause her to change her mind. And I realized that was not a very good plan of action either. And, just to complicate things, we ended up buying a house together, and the closing was on the date that would have been our wedding day, May 15th, 1983. Now, imagine how that conversation with my mom went when I called her up and said, we didn't get married, but we bought a house. I'd love to tell you that this is a story that has a happy ending, and that might indeed be the case, but I have to say that we're not at the end yet. We ultimately did get married, and we're 33 years into what has been, a very interesting journey so far. I definitely recommend doing the divorce before the marriage. It's a good way to go. You get the pain and the angst out of the way, and it's a lot cheaper. You don't have to hire lawyers and such. And, I guess I would say that, ours is not a perfect marriage, but it's been pretty damn good, especially if you go by the definition of a good marriage is one where divorce doesn't cross your mind, but, occasionally murder does. Sometimes you get lucky and, love works. The vow is till death do us part. And right. I'm kind of betting on natural right. causes or a plane crash and mm-hmm. hoping it's not because Liz strangles me. Right. Anyhow, right. if she's right. listening, Love you, Lizzie.
Yeah,
happy Valentine's Day.
Well, it's the optimism that I love in Paul's stories. But, you know, and that's a funny story. It's a funny story. But, you know, one of the things that I do want to point out is the obvious, and that is sometimes these stories are sad. You know, they're a little sad. But like Jackie's story sounded sad, but it wasn't. It was uplifting in the sense that you know how love is alive. And I'm totally convinced that because we don't take a lot of photographs of sad things, you notice that? We don't take photographs of sad things. We have to document these things that are less than marvelously funny in our lives. And I think that storytelling is really the best way of doing it. Great story. Great story. Ray, your birthday is on Valentine's Day, isn't it?
Yes,
it is.
Do
I remember that correctly?
Yes, it is.
So do you get like two gifts? You get like two bags of Peeps? Or what do you
get? I actually give out twice as much on my birthday.
Right.
Than I expect in, because I'm a giving person, you know.
Right.
You know.
Peeps. Do you guys eat Peeps on Valentine's Day? No, it's an Easter special.
It's an Easter special.
It's now
right.
meandered into Valentine's Day.
Peeps,
I'm just letting
really
you know
good
that.
Glued on a car.
I love Peeps.
Although
you know, you
have
put
to
it
say
on
I got
paper
a great
plate,
cake for my
throw
wife.
It in the microwave for 10 seconds, and you're good to go. You are good to go.
Peeps.
Ray, earlier you told us about the caretaker of Donbridge, and now. The Lanterns of Donbridge. It's a beautiful tale of love lost. Tell us the story.
Sharp February winds blew about the fields of my family's farm on the night of my birthday. In the driveway, family members and friends were stopping at our house. Late to arrive were my grandmother and grandfather. Just as my grandmother entered the front door of our kitchen, a large gust of wind blew a tree across the power lines, knocking the lights out of the street. My mother quickly found a propane lantern, which she lit, and my father proceeded to light the candles of my chocolate vanilla frosted cake. Singing filled the room as I watched everyone under the hallowed light of the lantern. When I blew out my candles, my grandmother came over to me. "You know, this reminds me of a very special couple who lived in my favorite town of Dunbridge," she said as she watched the flickering lantern on the table. A young couple named Christine and Joseph Woodlock lived in a small log cabin on the edge of Dunbridge. The couple had met many years ago as children while attending the schoolhouse in the town. Both of their families were farmers, and so communication was always constant between them, as their bartering and deals were always often made between their families. Christine, who was a musician of sorts and a hiking adventurer, led these charms that Joseph drew right to her automatically. Joseph was an inventor and was crafty at approaching problems. These attributes intrigued Christine. Over the years, the two had made a strong bond and never left each other's side until one day an accident forced them apart. It was late summer, and Christine decided to head to the tamarack forest to search for wild strawberries. Hike along the various twists and turns, she came along an area unknown to her. She had been looking at the ground for so long, she never realized where she had traveled to. As she tried to resolve her directional plight, a fierce wind bared down on the forest. Christine realized a storm was taking shape, and she needed to find shelter. Seeing a large cavern, she ran to it and tucked herself below its eaves. Just as she turned to watch the storm, a massive tree fell across the entrance, trapping her inside. Christine decided to travel deeper into the tunnel, which, oddly enough, had a bright light shining at the other end of its end. When she reached the other side, she cleared the entire steerage mountain range and was now beyond the Valley of Dunbridge. She soon realized that returning home seemed impossible. Back home, Joseph paced about the yard as no one had heard or seen Christine at all. Joseph began searching the forests, fields, and valleys, and the help of the townsfolk. All of the Dunbridge looked for Christine for weeks and never found her. One night the sun had set and Joseph went to his kitchen where his lit lantern and began to pour tea from the hearth kettle. He poured water and looked at the lantern, and soon an idea came to mind. The next day, Joseph gathered the town elders and proposed the town allow him to create lanterns in order to keep the town bright in the evenings. People marveled, and yet they had no idea how this would happen or how they would be powered. Joseph asked that he be the one to create them and install them, and the elders agreed, so he set to work. Joseph decided to power the lanterns by means of the methane produced from the farms in the region, so he piped each farm together and then routed the gas at the town center. There he connected each pipe to a freestanding lantern which he had crafted by the blacksmith. Soon, lantern after lantern became lit in the town, and the light reached the horizon of the mountaintops. Seeing the lights touch the sky, Joseph fashioned a sign that reflected into the sky the word Christine. Soon the hallowed image was brightly shown against the evening sky. Christine, who had been missing for a month, saw the beacon and began to weep. Gathering herself, she began to walk toward the beacon each night. By the 14th day of February, she reached Dunbridge as the evening fell and found Joseph, who was preparing the lanterns for yet another evening. Knowing his love was found, Joseph never lit the beacon again, but the lantern stayed lit as a symbol to all who longed for home. When my grandmother finished, the main lights of our house came on, and a knock at the door resounded. My grandmother went to the door and led a smiling man into the kitchen. "Well, hello, Joseph. Out working on the lights, I see," my grandmother proclaimed. The man continued to smile and said, "You know me. I'm always making sure the lanterns and beacons are lit, just in case someone is trying to get home."
Beautiful imagery. Really, really beautiful imagery, Ray. Artie Vincent, Paul Topeke, and Jackie Ford with stories about love of sorts on this So What's Your Story? Valentine's special on KPFT 90.1, Pacifica Radio, driven by peace. Love lost is painful. Lebanese American poet Khalil Gibran claimed, "Ever has it been that love knows not its own depth until the hour of separation." But I want you to hear something really very sweet. It's a sweet, simple story about love found. Walter Blanchard, actually a professor who Nicole has this semester, told this story a couple of years ago about meeting his wife. Let's listen a little bit, Nicole, just for a couple of minutes, actually.
Thousands of you have heeded the call.
So, a high school student, football player, good student, got some breaks along the way and was able to, because of my athletics, take some extra credits in the summer so that I could have more time during the football season to practice and be there. I found myself in a class where my football coach was the teacher. And the pretty girl that sat across the room from me caught my attention. He noticed it too. And he said, "You know, if you'd pay more attention to the civics lesson instead of that blonde girl, you'd probably do better in this class." I knew I was going to make an A anyway, but that's the way he talked to me. So I thought about this blonde girl, this beautiful girl. She was a senior. I also noticed that every time she left the class, some boy was carrying her books. And I came home that day and I told my mother, I said, "Boy, there's a great-looking girl in my civics class, and I'd love to ask her out." And my mother said, "Well, pick up the phone." I said, "Well, you don't understand. You see, I'm a junior, and she's a senior, and she might turn me down." She said, "Well, so what if she turned you down?" I said, "Well, you don't grasp this. You know, everybody would know she turned me down because that's how the word gets out at the school." She said, "And so what?" I said, "Mother, you just don't get it," like that. Well, one thing led to another, and one day after another, I watched that girl out of the corner of my eye, and every day she got prettier looking to me, and I kept thinking, I want to ask her out. And I would come home from time to time after school, and I told my mother, "You know, I'm going to ask her out." But every time I reached for the phone, it weighed 1,000 pounds, and I couldn't pick it up because I just feared the rejection. I was a fairly confident guy, but with girls, I was pretty shy. Well, one day I came home from school, and my mother and I were having a Coke there, and the phone rang, and she picked it up, and she said, "Well, yes, he's right here. Hang on." And my mother handed me the phone, and she said, "It's Sue on the phone." And I thought, be still my heart. Sue? My goodness. So I took the phone, and someone said, and by the way, I'd never talked to that blonde girl, so I had no idea what her voice was like. She said, "Would you like to go to the big dance with me?" I said, "Of course," without any hesitation. She said, "Well, you'll have to wear a tuxedo." And I said, "No problem." And she said, "Well, that's great. Let's talk in the morning at school, and we'll solidify things." I said, "Okay, good." And, boy, I put the phone down. I felt so great. My mother said, what happened?" I said, "The very girl I wanted to ask out, the very girl, you know, has called me to ask me out." She said, "See what I mean? I mean, you know, why were you ever worried in the first place?" So on the way to school the next morning with my friends, we drove together. And I told them that the senior, the most beautiful senior in the class, had asked me to the big dance. Well, these guys thought, "Man, I don't think you deserve that, but I'm glad you got it, and good for you." We used to meet in the cafeteria, like all kids do at most high schools. Walked in that morning, I looked around, and I didn't see that girl, but another girl came walking up. And she said, "I'm so glad that you agreed to go to the dance. Oh. It was another suit.
Oh, boy.
I couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. My friends were laughing, and the girl said, what are they laughing about? I said, it's nothing. Don't worry about that. She said, well, we'll go to the dance, and I'm going to give you my address, and here's my phone number. And I went, okay, great. They gave me a hard time. I went home that afternoon and told my mother that the wrong Sue had called me. She said, well, it's not the wrong Sue. It's just another Sue. I said, Mother, she said, you are going to take her to the dance. I said, no, I'll take her for sure. So I grumbled. The dance came the day of the dance. I washed the car. I picked up the corsage I'd ordered for. I picked up the tuxedo. I dressed up, and I went to this girl's house. This girl was a year younger than me. So she was actually 2 years younger than the blonde girl I described earlier in the story. I knocked on the door. Her mother and father were there. And I looked up at the top of the stairs, and this was a different creature. She had her hair done, her fingernails. Her mother had built her a dress. She looked gorgeous. She came down the stairs with a beautiful smile. Her father took two rolls of film on an old Kodak camera with us, the same pose over and over again, with me smiling. We walked out to the car. We went to the dance. She was a delightful date. One thing led to another, and we went out to, you know, dinner with some other people. I didn't know it that we were going out to dinner, and frankly, I was completely broke by the time I had bought the corsage and rented the tuxedo. And somehow she sensed that. And despite everybody ordering lobster and other things, you know, we were all excited, you know, she turned to me and said, I'm not very hungry. How about you? And I said, not really. So we bought a $2 appetizer, you know, and shared it. And I took her home that night, kissed her on the steps. I know her parents were looking through the blinds. And she said, I've had the time of my life. And she walked inside. I felt great. I undid my bow tie. I turned the windows down in the car. I drove around for a long time thinking about things. So when I came home that night, my mother was still up. She used to stay up for me. How was it? I said, it was great. She said, well, what about that other girl? I said, I'm going to call her tomorrow. I don't have any problem with that. I reached for that phone and called it. And that girl said, I'd be glad to go out with you. And so we went out. And now we've been married 50 years.
You know, it's a simple story, really, but all I think about when I think about that story are all the times I used to call girls up on a date, and I would swear I just hung up before they would pick up the phone. Did you ever do that? Jackie, I bet you had a lot of people call you. Did you ever get that, right?
You would be wrong about that.
Oh, really? Okay. All right.
I was in high school, anyway. but no, I think that's an absolutely wonderful story. You know, unexpected love that comes down the stairs.
That is wonderful. What a wonderful story. That is so cool. Very, very good. All right. Ray, what is your favorite love scene from a film?
Sleep is in Seattle at the top of the Empire State Building at the end.
You said that pretty quickly, right?
Yeah,
clear image. Jackie, have you got one? Your favorite romantic scene from a film?
Oh, that's really, really hard. It's probably, you know, at the airport in Casablanca.
Ah, beautiful.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, Nicole from the Peanut Gallery wants to be called on. Nicole, I didn't know that you watched movies that were done in black and white and stuff, but go ahead. What do you got in mind?
I do Swing Time with Fred Astaire.
Are you serious? You know who Fred Astaire is?
I do. I beg your pardon.
My God,
yes.
You know, you live long enough and you become incredibly surprised. That's good for you.
Right, yes, when he
good
when he
for you.
Yes, when he takes the groom's pants because he's like, she's not going to marry my sweetheart. They switched them and he's like, marry me. And she's like, I'm not going to marry you. And she married Fred instead.
Very nice. I'm so shocked. I'm shocked, actually. Paul.
You know, I like the very end of Tootsie, you know, when Dustin Hoffman and Jessica Lange are just walking down the sidewalk, and she's asking if she can borrow that little yellow Spock.
I love it, love it,
I love that one.
I got to go with Born on the 4th of July when Tom Cruise is soaked and he comes into the gym the night of the prom, you know, dancing with his girlfriend. None of you know what I'm talking about, do you? And they start playing Moon River. Nobody knows what I'm talking. Jackie, do you know what I'm talking about?
Sorry, can't help you.
You know what? I've had it.
But it was a great love scene.
It was a great love scene. My God.
Love scene.
You know,
now I'm going to have to go watch it.
Moon River was being played. Okay. Well, never mind. You'll have
We're
to take my
word
I can hum it
back.
For you, but I don't
it
know
was
that.
Really, it was just absolutely, it was unbelievable. Now, listen, Ray, I know you had another story. We're not going to get to, but I need you to give us a quick summary, because I want you to tell us how we can find your stuff anyway. Give us a 30-second summary of the story with Bread Comes Fish, because this is about generosity.
Mm-hmm.
Don't want to put you on the spot, but tell us what that story is about.
The story basically is about a man who lived on the outskirts of Dunbridge on his own, and he basically was a recluse. He was a hermit, but he decided to join into the society of Dunbridge and realized they didn't have a bake shop, so he decided to start baking bread for the town, and then finds out that the reverend tells him that the town had no fish in any of their ponds. And basically, he had a pond that had fish in it, so he uses the bread to lure the ducks out of his pond to bring them to the ponds of his Dunbridge. And when the ducks get into the ponds, all the algae that's on their feet actually have fish eggs on there that they put into those ponds, and then all the other ponds have fish at the end.
You got a website?
I do. DunbridgeSeries.com. And all my recipes are Folktales with Recipes.
And yeah, we're going to put that up. Nicole's going to put that up afterwards. Beautiful, 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 beautiful. Any shout-outs, you guys? Anybody? Paul?
I've got some ladies listening, and
of course you do. Of course you do.
But
you've
a shout
Eileen,
out to shout
got
out,
your wife.
Shout, Eileen and Liz. But right. Shout out to my daughter Em and Chantria if she's out there, and Jay Z the granddaughter.
Anna, Nicholas, I love you. Thanks for listening tonight.
Jackie,
My daughters Lydia and Grace.
Beautiful. You guys are so wonderful, so wonderful. Thank you, Artie Vinson, Paul Topekian, and Jackie Ford for tonight's mix of wit and whimsy, tenderness and warmth, and all of it framed by the kind of storytelling talent that most can only envy. Love Letters with Mary next week. Whether you're in love or not, always ensure that the roads that you take are filled with love and not hate. This is a dedication to my magnificent wife, Peggy, REO Speedwagon. Keep on loving you. Breaking away from our usual intro, so I want you to enjoy this and stay where you are, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are up next with classics for the cooler you. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turn it in for the night or just chilling, join us every Wednesday for So What's Your Story? Treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, and we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. Every word I said when I said that I love you, I meant that I love you forever. And I'm gonna keep on loving you.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
By joining KPFT's Sustainer program this hour, you can support your local non-commercial station and help KPFT reduce its pledge drives. Rather than giving a yearly gift, Sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving 5, 20, 100, or more monthly helps change the way KPFT works. Sustainers help us meet our operating expenses without days and days of on-air fundraising. That means less pledge drive, more efficiency, and greater stability for KPFT, regardless of the time of year. Again, visit KPFT.org to make a difference today. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, KPFT.org worldwide.
You are listening to KPFT Houston. Hello, it's that.